Hello, and welcome to the last of our webinars on proposed changes to the IASB's conceptual framework. I'm Joan Brown, and I'll be discussing the implications of the proposed changes. You can download the slides for this presentation by clicking on the Event Resources button to the left of the slides. This webinar is a recording, so I won't be able to take questions, but at the end I will give you links to pages of the IASB website where you'll be able to find more information if you need it. And finally, we always remind listeners that any views expressed in our presentations are those of the presenters and not necessarily those of the IASB or the IFRS Foundation. Remember this in particular when we get to the case study later in the webinar. I prepared the case study myself. It's not part of the exposure draft issued by the IASB. This webinar is the last one in a series that we are recording during the comment period for the Conceptual Framework Exposure Draft. The earlier webinars are already available on the IASB's website. Each of those webinars focused on particular changes that the IASB is proposing to make to its conceptual framework. And in this final webinar, I'll be explaining some of the implications of those changes. The implications really fall into two categories. First, the immediate implications for preparers of financial statements, and secondly, the longer-term implications for future standard setting. Let's start by considering the immediate implications for preparers of financial statements. I could summarise this slide by saying that the immediate implications will not be great for most entities. The conceptual framework is not a standard and it does not override standards, so entities will continue to apply existing standards even where there is a possible inconsistency between those standards and the revised concepts. This means that entities will be affected only if a particular standard requires them to apply the conceptual framework for a particular purpose. So, for example, they may be required to apply the conceptual framework to select an accounting policy for a particular transaction in two situations. First, if no standard specifically applies to that transaction, and in that situation, entities have to consider IAS 8, paragraph 11 of which requires entities to consider the framework in developing and applying an accounting policy. And then secondly, entities could be affected if a standard permits a choice of accounting policies. In these situations, entities have to consider the requirements of IAS 1. Paragraph 15 of IAS 1 requires entities to present fairly the financial position, financial performance, and cash flows of the entity in accordance with the definitions and recognition criteria set out in the framework. In a separate exposure draft, the IASB is proposing that, on issuing a revised conceptual framework, references in individual standards would be updated so that the standards would refer to the revised conceptual framework instead of the existing framework. Because the concepts would have changed, some entities might need to change their accounting policies. The IASB is proposing that entities should account for most of those changes retrospectively in accordance with IAS 8. Some entities would need time to identify and understand the effects of the amendments on their accounting policies and to prepare for a retrospective application. So the IASB proposes to give a transition period of 18 months. Early application would be permitted for those entities that didn't need the 18 months for transition. The more significant implications of the conceptual framework proposals lie in the way in which the new concepts could affect future standard setting. The IASB will not change automatically any existing standard as a result of changes to the conceptual framework. If an existing standard works well in practice, the IASB will not propose an amendment simply because the standard is inconsistent with the revised concepts. Any decision to amend an existing standard would require the IASB to go through its normal due process for adding a project to its agenda and developing an exposure draft and an amendment to that standard. However, if the IASB takes on a project to develop or amend a standard, it would be guided by the new concept. It believes that the proposed changes will give it a more complete, clear, and updated set of concepts to work from, and that those concepts would help it to develop standards that better meet the needs of investors, lenders, and other creditors. To illustrate how the proposed concepts could help the ISB, I'm going to explain how I think the ISB could apply them if it takes on a project to amend aspects of IAS 37, the standard addressing provisions, contingent liabilities, and contingent assets. The ISB doesn't have such a project at the moment, but within its research program, it's gathering evidence to help it decide whether to start one. As part of that research, I've considered whether and how the proposed new conceptual framework might help. This is my own personal analysis, not one that's been approved by the IASB. But it might be of interest to you if you're commenting on the proposed changes to the conceptual framework, or if you're participating in the IASB's current agenda consultation and forming views on the relative importance and urgency of various possible future projects, including the possible project to amend IAS 37. My overall conclusion is that the proposed concepts would be useful. They could provide the IASB with the direction it needs to improve the aspects of IAS 37 that need to be improved without changing the aspects that are working well at present. And I think that the conceptual framework proposals could be relevant in considering three aspects of IAS 37 in particular. Firstly, the guidance on identifying liabilities, or in other words, working out when an entity has a present obligation. Secondly, the recognition criteria, the circumstances in which an entity should make provision for an identified liability in its statement of financial position. And finally, the measurement requirements, how an entity should measure any provision that it does recognise. So we'll start by considering the guidance on identifying liabilities. The problem at the moment is that aspects of the existing guidance in IAS 37 seem contradictory. On one hand, paragraph 19 of IAS 37 states that only obligations existing independently of an entity's future actions are recognised as provisions. This statement is often interpreted as meaning that liabilities must be unconditional. An entity does not have a liability for obligations that it could avoid through its future actions, even if those future actions are unrealistic. On the other hand, paragraph 10 of IAS 37 defines an obligating event as an event that results in the entity having no realistic alternative to settling the obligation. This statement is often interpreted as meaning that an entity does have a liability for obligations that could be avoided through its future actions if those actions are unrealistic. Because of the apparent contradictions, it's unclear how unavoidable an obligation must be. This lack of clarity has given rise to problems in practice. And in response to requests for more guidance for levies in particular, the IFRS Interpretations Committee issued IFRIC 21. The Interpretations Committee applied the guidance in paragraph 19 of IAS 37 and concluded that an entity does not have a present obligation to avoid a levy if it could avoid the levy through its future actions, irrespective of whether those actions are realistic. However, that interpretation has not provided a completely satisfactory solution. The first problem is that the consensus in IFRIC 21 appears inconsistent with other requirements in IAS 37, especially requirements for restructuring costs. IAS 37 requires entities to recognise liabilities for restructuring costs when they have announced or started to implement a restructuring plan. And the rationale is that once an entity has announced or started to implement a plan, it's got no realistic alternative other than to complete it. But it's unclear why one principle applies to levies and another to restructuring costs. So it's unclear which principle should apply to other transactions within the scope of IAS 37, but not specifically discussed there. A second problem is that IFRIC 21 has been criticised by a wide range of stakeholders, including investors, lenders and regulators. IFRIC 21 results in some recurring periodic levies being recognised as expenses at a single point in time. People have expressed concern about this outcome because they think that the economic substance of a recurring levy is that the entity is paying to operate over a period, and that this substance would be more faithfully represented by spreading the expense over the period to which the levy refers. I think that the concepts proposed in the conceptual framework exposure draft could provide a basis for improving the requirements and guidance in this area. As we discussed in a previous webinar, the exposure draft proposes to define the term present obligation and to explain how that definition would apply to the particular type of obligation that gives rise to problems in IAS 37. That is, obligations that the entity could, in theory at least, avoid through its future actions. The proposed concept would clarify that an obligation to transfer an economic resource could meet the definition of a liability, even if the entity could avoid the transfer through its future actions. The entity would be viewed as having a liability if it had no practical ability to avoid the future transfer, and if the obligation had arisen from past events. It would be viewed as having no practical ability to avoid the transfer if it had no practical ability to avoid the actions that triggered the transfer. And the obligation would be viewed as having arisen from past events if the entity had already received the benefits or conducted the activities that established the extent of its obligations. I think that applying those concepts, the requirements for some transactions within the scope of IAS 37 would change, and in particular the requirements for levies. Applying the proposed concepts, the ISB might conclude that a liability to pay a levy could arise before the activity that triggers payment of the levy. The liability would arise earlier if the amount of the levy is established by reference to earlier activities, and if, when the entity conducts those earlier activities, it has no practical ability to avoid the later activity that triggers payment. Suppose, for example, an entity will be required to pay a levy that's a percentage of its revenue for the current period, but only if it's still operating in a particular market on a specified day in the next period. The liability would be identified as arising as the entity generates revenue in the current period if the entity has no practical ability to leave the specified market before the date on which the levy becomes payable. In such a situation, the liability would accumulate over the current period as the entity generates revenue. And in general, I think that liabilities for many accumulating levies would be recognised incrementally over the period to which the levy refers. There could also be a change in the way in which we'd look at restructuring costs, but I think the change would be more in the way of which the requirements were expressed, rather than necessarily the practical outcome. Applying the proposed concepts, I don't think that the announcement of a restructuring plan could be viewed as sufficient on its own to give rise to a liability. It's not an activity that in itself establishes the extent of the entity's obligations, because the act of announcing a restructuring plan doesn't result in an increase in the costs of carrying out that plan. But an announcement could provide evidence that the entity no longer has the practical ability to avoid the future transfer. So, if the entity has already met the first criterion, in other words, it's received the benefits or conducted the activities that established the extent of its obligations if it were to restructure, the announcement of the restructuring plan could be the event that causes the second criterion to be met, i.e. the no practical ability to avoid criterion. So let's take an example. Suppose an entity has already received the employee services that establish the extent of the employee's right to redundancy payments. In that situation, the announcement of a restructuring plan could trigger the recognition of a liability for those restructuring costs. So, although the proposed concepts could lead to a change in the way in which the requirements for restructuring costs were expressed, I think provisions for many restructuring costs would probably be recognised at the same time as they are at present. Let's move on now and think about how the proposed concepts could affect the IAS 37 recognition criteria. At present, provisions are recognised only if three criteria are all met. First, if on the basis of all available evidence, it's more likely than not that a present obligation exists. And secondly, if it's probable, which in IAS 37 means more likely than not, that an outflow of resources will be required to settle the obligation. And thirdly, if a reliable estimate can be made of the amount of the obligation. These recognition criteria have been the subject of much debate in the past. A particular concern has been the inclusion of the second criterion, the probable outflows criterion. The IASB has omitted the probable outflows criterion from other standards, such as the Business Combination Standard, IFRS 3, and the Financial Instruments Standard, IFRS 9. And in previous projects, the IASB proposed to remove the criterion from IAS 37. The IASB thought that this would improve financial reporting. The requirements of IAS 37 would be more consistent with those of other standards. An entity's statement of financial position would be more complete. And by measuring these low probability liabilities at an amount that reflected their low probability, recognising them would provide relevant information. However, the proposal was widely opposed and in the end it was never implemented. And I think that if the IASB were to start a new project to amend aspects of IAS 37, the concepts proposed in the Conceptual Framework Exposure Draft might lead it to different conclusions from those it reached in the past. The Conceptual Framework Exposure Draft proposes a new way of looking at recognition. It starts by noting that failure to recognise assets and liabilities makes the financial statements less complete and can exclude useful information. But it goes on to acknowledge that recognition of some assets and liabilities might not provide useful information, or at least information that is sufficiently useful to justify the cost of providing it. So recognition requirements may need to vary between standards. And the exposure draft proposes that when the IASB is developing standards, it should consider three factors. Whether a requirement to recognise a particular asset or liability would give relevant information about the asset or the liability and about any income, expenses or changes in equity. Whether recognition would provide a faithful representation. It might not, for example, if the related asset or liability is not recognised. And thirdly, whether the benefits of recognition exceed the costs. The exposure draft goes on to discuss factors that might cause information to lack relevance. It identifies existence uncertainty, low probability of inflows or outflows, and exceptionally high measurement uncertainty as possible contributing factors. So in other words, the same factors that underpin the IAS 37 recognition criteria. So I think the proposed recognition concept could provide a basis for retaining the existing recognition criteria in IAS 37. The need to consider whether recognition of a particular type of liability provides useful information means that consistency with other standards would not in itself be a reason for changing IAS 37. And liabilities within the scope of IAS 37 do have characteristics that distinguish them from other liabilities and which could justify different recognition criteria. In particular, most liabilities within the scope of IAS 37 cannot be measured by reference to an observable transaction price. They tend not to be traded, so tend not to have an observable current transaction price. And perhaps more unusually, they typically haven't even arisen from an exchange transaction that provides an observable historical transaction price. Where observable transaction prices exist, they can often be obtained at relatively low cost, take into account the probable outcome, and are subject to relatively little measurement uncertainty. So, even if the only observable transaction price for a liability is a historical one, there may be at least one measure of the liability for which the benefits of recognition exceed the cost. And it might be that it's better to recognise that amount than recognise nothing at all. But when no observable transaction price exists, there might be no measure of the liability that can be obtained at reasonable cost. It can be argued that the need for recognition criteria in IAS 37 stems from the absence of any observable transaction price, and that the three recognition criteria in IAS 37 at present are precisely those needed to filter out liabilities for which the cost of recognition might exceed the benefits. Finally, let's take a look at the IAS 37 measurement requirements. I think it's fairly widely accepted that the measurement requirements in IAS 37 aren't as clear as those in some other standards. IAS 37 requires entities to measure provisions at the best estimate of the expenditure required to settle the present obligation at the end of the reporting period, but it doesn't explain very clearly what the best estimate of a single obligation would be if there's a range of possible outcomes. Is it the most likely outcome, or the probability weighted average of all the possible outcomes, or some other amount within the range? And unlike most other standards, IAS 37 doesn't specify which costs should be included in any measure of future expenditure. In practice, entities include at least the incremental costs of materials and services, but they vary in the extent to which they also include indirect costs, such as an allocation of fixed or variable overheads. IAS 37 goes on to explain that the best estimate is the amount the entity would rationally pay to settle the obligation at the end of the reporting period or to transfer it to a third party at that time. But these amounts could be different. Which one should the entity measure and in what circumstances? And that's not all. IAS 37 requires the measurements to take into account risks and uncertainties, but it doesn't say how. And although it suggests that a risk adjustment may be required, it doesn't explain when that would be the case. And finally, IAS 37 requires future cash flows to be discounted to the present value, but it doesn't specify whether the discount rate should take into account the risk of non-performance by the entity, i.e. the entity's own credit risk. And practices in this area diverge. Although predominant practice is to exclude own credit risk, some entities include it. And that can mean that some entities are recognizing smaller liabilities as a result. The measurement concepts proposed in the conceptual framework exposure draft wouldn't provide answers to all of these questions, but I think they would help with some of them. Of particular relevance to IAS 37 is the proposal that in selecting a measurement basis for an asset or a liability, it's important to consider how that asset or liability contributes to future cash flows. This proposal could lead the IASB to conclude that entities should measure liabilities within the scope of IAS 37 in a way that reflects the intended method of settlement. Entities tend to settle most liabilities within the scope of IAS 37 by fulfilling the obligations themselves. The nature of the obligations is such that the entities typically do not have the practical ability, or sometimes even a legal right, to transfer the obligations to another party or to negotiate release with a counterparty. This could lead the IASB to focus on a measurement that the conceptual framework exposure draft calls fulfillment value, and which it defines as the present value of the cash flows that an entity expects to incur as it fulfills a liability. The conceptual framework exposure draft proposes that fulfillment value reflects the same factors as fair value, but measured from the perspective of the entity rather than a market participant, which means that, in principle, fulfillment value reflects at least four factors: estimates of future cash flows, possible variations in the amount and timing of those cash flows, the price for bearing the uncertainty inherent in the cash flows, or in other words, a risk adjustment, and the time value of money. However, the exposure draft goes on to say that, in practice, fulfillment value may sometimes need to be customized to provide the most useful information. I think this proposal suggests that if the IASB were to specify a form of fulfillment value measurement basis in IAS 37, it could consider whether, and if so how, to customize that basis to provide the most useful information about the cost and the expense, and to take into account the cost constraint. Feedback that the IASB received in its previous project to amend IAS 37 suggests that if the IASB were to take this approach, it might consider permitting or requiring entities to measure some liabilities by reference to the most likely outcome, with disclosure of information about other possible outcomes, instead of at the probability-weighted average of all possible outcomes. And it might also consider requiring entities to exclude the effects of their own credit risk, and possibly to exclude any risk adjustment. So that's a summary of my personal views on how the concepts proposed in the Conceptual Framework Exposure Draft could help the IASB to improve IAS 37 if it takes on a project to amend that standard. If you'd like to look at the analysis in more detail, you'll find it in Agenda Paper 14C, which was discussed at an IASB agenda education session in July 2015. The paper is available on the provisions page of the IASB website, along with another one listing all the matters that have been identified as possible problems with IAS 37. And you can find out more about the Conceptual Framework Project on the Conceptual Framework Project page of the IASB website. From that page, you'll also be able to submit comments on the exposure draft or register to receive email alerts about the project. Thank you for listening.